quite a large majority thought that the biggest lessons from the war was that the United States should not be in the business of nation building.
Americans want more diplomacy. It's Thursday, October 7th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Afghans continue to resettle in the U.S. President Biden travels roads and bridges. Big pressure on Facebook. Business bust and boom in Asia. Avatars for the metaverse. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A new national survey conducted by the Eurasia Group Foundation is finding that most Americans say they want more diplomacy and fewer U.S. military deployments around the world. The findings come in the first large-scale opinion poll conducted since the end of the 20-year U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has details.
With the last U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan in August after 20 years, President Joe Biden told the United Nations that the United States is pivoting from an era of relentless war to an era of relentless diplomacy. A new national survey of 2,000 U.S. voters finds that most Americans appear to agree. A majority of those polled by the Eurasia Group Foundation want to decrease the number of U.S. troops stationed overseas and reduce security commitments abroad, while 58% say they want to increase U.S. diplomatic engagement. Caroline Gray is a lead researcher on the survey.
And we found that 62%, quite a large majority, thought that the biggest lessons from the war was that the United States should not be in the business of nation building, or that it should only send troops into harm's way if vital national interests are threatened.
The report notes among younger voters, ages 18 to 29, 80% believe that unless the United States is under attack, the president should be required to seek congressional approval before ordering military action overseas.
65% of younger Americans want to revive nuclear negotiations with Iran. They're more skeptical of America increasing its military presence in East Asia to counter a rising China. And a majority of them also want to scale back U.S. defense spending. So they're a lot more likely than their older counterparts to want to scale back America's military posture and reliance on the military in solving global challenges.
Americans appear divided on the best approach to China and Russia, according to the survey, with 40% saying they are unsure about what the U.S. should do if China were to invade Taiwan. This appears to contrast with what one expert said is the bipartisan consensus among U.S. foreign policy leaders.
I think in the security realm, Washington, D.C., as you well know, is obsessed with China as a rising competitor. The president himself has talked very often about this era that we're moving in, an era of great power competition, an era of democracy versus autocracy. And a real concern that China, as an autocracy that has a lot of resources and a clear plan and intentionality to dominate kind of the global discussion.
The survey found that humanitarian aid, disaster relief, and COVID-19 relief are the most popular types of international assistance, while military assistance and weapons sales are the least popular. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
You can dive into much more in this story by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and at our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Envoy says ASEAN discusses excluding Myanmar junta chief from summit. French senators arrive in Taiwan amid tensions with China. Biden's national security advisor meets with ranking Chinese diplomat. Australia urged to boost military cooperation with Taiwan. Why Chinese weapons exports are declining despite loyal clientele. Expanding coverage of all these stories and so much more can be found daily. Visit us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and stop by our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Many who fled Afghanistan during the U.S. troop withdrawal are now located at U.S. military installations across the country. They're waiting for resettlement to host communities. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, donations and support for Afghans continue to pour in, while aid organizations are preparing to help them find housing and jobs.
When Kyle Vandenplas heard Afghans were coming to Fort McCoy, not far from his Wisconsin home, he immediately jumped into action.
As soon as I read the email, within 10 minutes, I had all my information down and I was signed up and ready to go.
Vandenplas volunteers with Team Rubicon, which is coordinating collection and delivery of donations and supplies pouring in for nearly 13,000 Afghan immigrants temporarily housed by the U.S. military at Fort McCoy.
They need basic necessities. Right now we're processing through diapers and feminine hygiene products and baby food and clothes by the trash bag full and getting it sorted and getting it distributed to the people in need.
Fort McCoy is a temporary processing location. Only about 400 Afghans will stay in Wisconsin. The rest will resettle in other host communities, such as Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
We are preparing to do our best receiving families.
After working for the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Norhul Haq Fazli left Afghanistan in 2018 on a special immigrant visa, or SIV. He is the only Afghan working for Jewish Family and Community Services, or JFCS, one of the agencies tasked with helping Afghans find housing and employment when they resettle in Pittsburgh. Fazli doesn't yet know the total number coming or when.
The problem is that we get a very short notice, maybe 5 hours. Like we had the last week, 5 hours notice, a family comes, you have to deal with that. So usually it was a month to do all this preparation, but now 5 hours.
Because this is a crisis situation, this is very different than the way things are typically handled.
JFCS President Jordan Golan says despite the rapid and chaotic evacuation of Afghans, any concerns about potential security risks to America are overblown.
Special immigrant visa holders, the SIVs, they're pretty similar to refugees. They're a special class of immigrants that undergo the most rigorous screenings of any immigrant that comes to this country. They have to be cleared by the State Department to come here, but before that, they go through multiple levels of screenings, which include health screenings, security, background checks. It's a very lengthy process. We know more about them when they come here than we do probably about pretty much anyone else who comes as a tourist or a student or anyone else.
The Afghan guests that are here have been vetted by, you know, our government, and they worked alongside us overseas and sacrificed a lot.
Sacrifices Vandenplas understands well. He is not only a Team Rubicon volunteer, but also a combat veteran of the U.S. Army's 2nd Infantry Division. He fought the Taliban in southern Afghanistan during the U.S. troop surge in 2009 and 2010.
I don't know that there's a day that goes by that I don't think about, you know, something that happened over there, or, you know, wake up from a dream that I have. And that's something that's permanently a part of me. It's a part of my story.
A story Vandenplas is still writing.
It's really a full circle thing for me.
Trading in a military vehicle roving the dusty roads of southern Afghanistan for a rental truck navigating the paved streets of northern Wisconsin, where he hopes delivering supplies to those in need helps heal him as much as it helps them.
They made a conscious choice to help the American troops for hopes of betterment of their country and their lives. And I think we owe it to them to continue and uphold our end of it.
Vandenplas says he'll continue to volunteer as long as there are newcomers arriving in America that need his help. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Sparta, Wisconsin.
There may be plenty of jobs for Afghan refugees if infrastructure is passed by the U.S. Congress. Still ahead on VOA Asia, President Biden promotes his plans. Happening now in Asia, in an annual policy address, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam defended the Beijing-imposed national security law and electoral changes, which have been criticized for silencing opposition voices and screening out candidates considered unpatriotic. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope you're having a great day wherever you happen to be listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us today. President Joe Biden traveled to Michigan Tuesday to promote his legislative priorities on infrastructure and social spending. The two bills are facing a stalemate in Congress, as members of Biden's own Democratic Party are wrangling over the size and scope of the package. From the White House, Patsy Whitaker-Swara has this report.
Investing in infrastructure and expanding social welfare programs are two key issues President Joe Biden campaigned on. With his legislative agenda stalled in Congress, he visited a worker training facility Tuesday in Howell, Michigan, to promote his plans.
It isn't enough just to invest in our physical infrastructure. We're going to lead the world like we used to. If we're going to do that, we have to also invest in our people, like you do right here in training, this training facility.
Biden pushed key legislative agendas, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that has bipartisan support, and the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan. It's championed by progressives to fund what they call human infrastructure, including education and climate change mitigation.
They don't increase the debt because they're paid for by asking the very wealthy to begin their pay their fair share. As a matter of fact, a significant portion of this plan cuts taxes for working people. And best of all, the cost of these bills in terms of adding to the deficit is zero.
The plans are stuck as lawmakers in Biden's own party disagree on its size and scope. Democratic centrist Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona say the $3.5 trillion package is too expensive and they want it trimmed. Meanwhile, progressives in the House of Representatives threatened to withdraw support for the $1.2 trillion infrastructure proposal unless the larger bill passes. Since the Senate is split 50-50, Democrats cannot afford to lose a single vote.
If those two things fail, the administration's going to have not a whole lot to show for its first year. And it also really calls into question, you know, kind of the core premise of the Biden presidency, which is focused, pragmatic, calm, legislative expert who can get things done. You know, if all of a sudden the Democratic Party spins out of control under his leadership, it really calls that kind of fundamental idea into question.
Biden visited lawmakers in Congress last week, but failed to get them to agree, despite popular support for some of the bill's components. Not only would it address the nation's crumbling infrastructure, but the bill would also provide for universal pre-kindergarten, lower-cost childcare, and paid family leave.
The pandemic revealed a lot of the frailties in the U.S. economy, and the legislation is now addressing some of those. You know, there's also been a significant focus on climate change in both of these pieces of legislation, which obviously matters a lot to the global community.
Biden's Michigan visit reflects the importance of securing moderate support by the October 31st vote deadline. The legislative deadline for Biden is October 18th. By which date Congress must vote to increase the debt ceiling to avoid potential global economic turbulence caused by the U.S. defaulting on its debt. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. The son of the Philippines' former dictator Ferdinand Marcos officially registered his candidacy for the 2022 presidential elections in the Philippines. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. presented his credentials for the vote in Manila. You'll find this and all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. Facebook finds itself in the hot seat again. A recent Wall Street Journal report cites internal knowledge of its harmful effects and the company's resistance to act. A whistleblower, a former Facebook employee, came out in public this week to testify against the social media company, only adding to the scrutiny. Tina Trin has her report on Facebook and shares it with us here.
Facebook, the social networking giant that also owns Instagram and WhatsApp, is in the spotlight once again.
I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy.
Frances Haugen worked at Facebook for 2 years as a project manager, but has since become known as the Facebook whistleblower. On Tuesday, Haugen testified at a Senate hearing about what she says is an intentional lack of action and transparency by the company and its related apps, such as Instagram. She said Facebook algorithms tend to promote falsehoods faster than the truth, citing misinformation campaigns that have spread in the U.S. and abroad.
The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people.
According to Facebook's own study, 32% of teenage girls on Instagram said that when they felt bad about their bodies, the site made them feel worse.
Facebook knows that its amplification algorithms, things like engagement-based ranking on Instagram, can lead children from very innocuous topics like healthy recipes, just something innocent like healthy recipes, to anorexia-promoting content over a very short period of time.
But Facebook says that Haugen only had a limited view of research and policy decisions at the social media firm and pointed that out during her testimony. Facebook's head of global safety appeared before senators last week.
Has Facebook ever found a change to its platform would potentially inflict harm on users, but move forward because the change would also grow users or increase revenue?
It's not been my experience at all at Facebook. We care deeply about the safety and security of the people on our platform. We've invested $12 billion in it. We have thousands and thousands of people working on this issue. That's just not how we would approach it.
We've had Facebook, you know, in testimonies, at hearings, also always saying they're going to do better, they're going to do different, and then they walk away and nothing happens, or nothing majorly happens. And I think that this is the first time that that's being documented about all the things that they actually had information about, things that they could have done, and they just didn't do it.
Some are comparing Facebook to a pivotal moment in the cigarette industries.
Facebook and big tech are facing a big tobacco moment, a moment of reckoning. When we learned of those files that showed not only that big tobacco knew that its product caused cancer, but that they had done the research, they concealed the files.
It remains to be seen if lawmakers and regulators will act to curtail Facebook's alleged harm. And it's not clear how Facebook will respond, even if the calls for change originate from within. Tina Trin, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, in Thailand, activists commemorated the anniversary of a massacre at the site where security forces opened fire on students 45 years ago. The killing stands out in Thailand's history as an example of brutality by authorities. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, commerce grinds to a halt in Afghanistan while movie cars move at auction. Chris Keskeo joins us with VOA Asia Business Scene.
Traders of carpets, antiques, and souvenirs on Kabul's famed Chicken Street said business has completely dried up since the vast majority of foreigners left the Afghan capital as the Taliban took over. The once bustling hotspot where aid workers and adventurous tourists would shop for vintage tribal rugs, poetry, and metalware is almost empty of visitors looking for a bargain. Carpet seller Abdul Wahab.
People are moving, but there's a feeling of uncertainty. They really don't know what's going to happen in the near future.
Wahab said most of his customers had been expats, such as NGO staff and diplomats, but almost all of them evacuated by the end of August, after the Taliban stormed to power in the weeks before. Vintage rugs can fetch thousands of dollars, which means only foreigners and the richest of Afghans are Wahab's target market. Asked how many rugs he now sells per week, the dealer said, "Now it's none." Chicken Street was hugely popular in the 1960s and 70s among Kabul's hippie trail visitors, who stayed in nearby guest houses and shopped for clothes and hashish. Tourism plummeted during and after the Soviet-Afghan War that started in 1979, but the street experienced a rebound after the U.S. invasion in 2001. A rare auto auction recently took place in Australia, selling a menacing fleet of vehicles from Mad Max Fury Road. It was a chance for would-be marauders or those just wanting to raise eyebrows at the drive-thru window. Senior classic car curator at Lloyd's Auctions, Jeff McHugh, had this to say about the collection.
It's amazing. When I saw it start for the first time, I wasn't sure if I was having a heart attack or a bowel movement. It's madness just seeing it.
Among the vehicles was the gargantuan War Rig, a hulking tanker driven by Charlize Theron's character, Furiosa, and the Razor Cola, which went up against Tom Hardy's Mad Max Rockatansky. The vehicles are part of an armada of wild machines that burst onto the screen in the award-winning Fury Road, the fourth film in George Miller's Mad Max franchise. The movie's success further cemented the cult status of the Australian action series and its title character, first played by Mel Gibson in 1979. Once again, Jeff McHugh.
To be used, the first time I saw him, I'm pretty sure I heard one of the cars saying, "I need to be driven in anger." These cars are built to be driven in anger. They need to be out there and respected and honored.
The sale aroused interest worldwide, including from Las Vegas casinos and the Burning Man Festival, McHugh said. Sadly, none of the cars are street legal. For Business Scene, I'm Chris Cascajo.
A company in suburban Washington, D.C. is using cutting-edge technology to create lifelike video avatars to drop into music and training videos, games, and other immersive environments. It's an entry point into the so-called metaverse, as VOA's Arzuma Kampore discovered while touring Avatar Dimension's new studio.
Hello, and welcome to Avatar Dimension.
At this Northern Virginia firm, a new way to blend virtual and physical realities is taking shape.
The viewing room features a large video wall where clients can sit and work while observing the recording session. It provides clients with the ability to preview the finished holograms together with the production team.
Ben Schwartz is the general manager at Avatar Dimension.
So this is our volumetric video studio.
The firm has the only certified Microsoft Mixed Reality Capture Studio on the U.S. East Coast, one of just five worldwide. The technology can create realistic video holograms and avatars for entertainment, training, and business videos, and more.
So our stage here is comprised of 70 cameras. They're arranged in a circle 20 feet across, all pointed inwards towards the person standing in the center. There is an 8-foot circle taped out here on the floor, which represents the usable capture space that we can record while filming.
To help me understand the process, Schwartz puts me in the circle within focus of all these cameras.
All right, ready? Here we go. One, two. And got it.
Yes. Our studio captures raw data at a rate of roughly 1.3 terabytes per minute. 1 minute of processing, real-time processing, takes roughly about a day. And when we're done, we'll process just the takes that we've identified as the best ones.
Avatar Dimension Vice President Kathy Hackle wrote a book, The Augmented Workforce, about how hyperconnectivity will upend life as we know it.
Web 1.0 connected information, and you got the internet. Web 2.0 connected people, and you got social media, and that's kind of where we're at right now. And Web 3.0, kind of where we're starting to go, connects people, places, and things. And sometimes these people, places, and things can be in our real world, our physical world, or they can be in a virtual world. When I think about the metaverse, I think about almost the internet breaking free from our phones and our computers and being all around us.
Hackle sees great potential in shared virtual environment, collectively known as the metaverse.
So I think that that'll unleash in itself a lot of opportunities because we're going to engage with technology in a much more human way, whether we're in Ghana or whether we're in Singapore or New York.
The line between virtual and physical reality continues to blur. In August, Facebook Horizon introduced virtual reality conference rooms so co-workers' avatars can sit together in a conference room. Can they also go out for lunch? Arzuma Kampore, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.